panic clutching at her throat. She'd never been arrested. Soto would give her up. The big cop, Davenport, ran across the lot and disappeared into the townhouse like an actor in a silent movie, and the black woman went in behind him. Then she heard the shots, a machine gun, not Soto's pistol. Was he dead? She put the car in gear and rolled toward the apartment complex. The man in the cargo shorts came out the back door and asked, "What happened?" "Sorry about that," Lucas said. Bob had Soto by one arm, Ray had him by the other. Lucas was off to the side. "We had a complicated situation out front, and he managed to get to your door. Didn't want to risk a shot with civilians around, like you." "He doesn't look all that tough," the man said. He was built like a construction worker, thick arms with a Statue of Liberty tattoo on the right bicep, a heavy gut. "I could have kicked his ass." "He is the worst man you'll ever see in person," Lucas said. "He might even be worse than anyone you'll ever see in the movies." "No kidding." The man was checking out Soto again. "No kidding." Ray and Bob were walking Soto around the building to the front parking lot, and Lucas hurried to catch up. Bob had his phone out and was talking to the Addison police, saying, "It would be helpful if we could have a crime scene person come by." And a second later, with a hand covering the phone's microphone, he called to Lucas, "They'll have some cops here in 5, crime scene guy in 10. Lucas said, "Okay." Ray was asking Soto, "Who were you trailing? We know you were trailing one of us and thought it might be..." They had come out from behind the building and were walking toward Lucas's Jeep. They would handcuff Soto to one of the steel seat supports and take him to the lockup at the federal building until they could arrange something more permanent. At that moment, the maroon Ford stopped on the street and a woman got out of the far side of the car and looked toward Lucas and the other three, and Lucas saw the gun coming up and screamed, "Down, everybody, get down!" And his gun was coming up, and as they all dropped to the ground, the woman swept them with a burst from an automatic rifle, and Lucas was banging away at the car with his .45, and Ray was struggling to get the M4 off her shoulder, and then the woman was in the car and speeding away. Lucas's mag was empty, and he dropped it and slammed in another, and he turned and looked, and Ray had her M4 up but wasn't firing, and Bob had his pistol up. The Ford made a turn at the corner and was gone. Lucas ran halfway to the Jeep, realized that a chase would be hopeless. The Ford was out of sight for too long. He'd have no idea of where she went in the tangle of streets around the airport. He stopped, said, "God damn it," and turned and hurried back to the others to see if anyone had been hurt. Bob was on the phone again, calling out a description, and said, "Then get me to 911. Wait a minute, I'll dial from here." Soto lay flat on the ground, face up, eyes open, and fixed. Ray still had her gun up, looking out at the surrounding streets, shook her head as Lucas walked back, and then they both walked over and looked down at Soto. Ray said, "My God." Soto's chest was soaked with blood. He'd been hit at least a half dozen times, Lucas thought. When he, Bob, and Ray had dropped to the ground, Soto had stayed upright, maybe thinking he could run out to the woman's car. Not a good idea. Bob was talking to a 911 operator, giving a description of the fleeing car and where it was last seen. Ray was staring at the body. "What the hell? What the hell was that?" Lucas said, "She wasn't shooting at us. She was taking out a guy who might talk." Ray squatted next to Soto and shook her head. The man in the cargo shorts came out the front door, a beer in his hand, and looked at them and said, "Oh boy, that's... oh boy." After that, it was paperwork and long conversations with bureaucrats at SOG and with Fort in Washington, and local cops coming and going, and the crime scene guy picking up the dropped revolver and brass and measuring distances. The medical examiner's van came, and Soto's body went away, and a crew from the fire department washed away a 6-foot-wide blood puddle on the tarmac. The local police hadn't seen the shooter's car, except when they saw too many of them. The Addison Police Department stopped 8 cars of the right description, but said they could have stopped 100 or 1,000 if they hadn't given up first. By nightfall, they were mostly done with the routine, and Russell Fort called from Washington and said, "We got a quick hit on the fingerprints. His birth name was Marco Obregon, born in Miami, but he changed it to Marco DeSoto, maybe to get out from under the other convictions. He's got a rap sheet about a mile long. Convicted on attempted murder and aggravated assault and simple assault. Acquitted on 1 charge of murder, no load on another. Convicted on possession of a firearm by a felon, acquitted on a couple of drug charges. He was like a walking monument to the credulity of parole boards. He's got an address in Coral Gables and an FBI is on the way there." "We need the name of the woman he was working with," Lucas said. "We're going for that," Fort said. "We haven't seen anything yet. Maybe the FBI guys will turn something up." Back at the hotel, Lucas, Bob, and Ray changed clothes and then met in the bar and ate nachos and drank a few margaritas, and Ray said, "This has been an unusual day." "Your people giving you a hard time?" Lucas asked. "Nothing like that. They're more like excited." "Wish I'd been there stuff," Ray said. Bob asked Lucas, "This happen to you much?" "From time to time," Lucas said. The weirdest thing about today was we might have saved Garvin Poole's life. Bob popped a handful of salted peanuts and said, "Didn't think of that, but you're right. As long as that woman doesn't catch up to him, she's the one I wouldn't want to meet in the dark." Chapter 17. Lucas was normally up late, but on this night, he'd turned the lights off at midnight, then lay awake in the dark thinking about the shooting and about Poole. At 2, he rolled over and looked at the clock. He needed some sleep, but he also wanted to get going early in the morning. Or get somebody else going. Ray had said she was an early bird. 2 o'clock certainly qualified as early. He turned on the bed light, crawled out of bed, picked up the phone, and called her room. She answered on the 5th or 6th ring and, sounding groggy, asked, "Who is this?" "Lucas, you got a pen or pencil?" "What happened?" she asked. "I had a thought, and I need you to do something tomorrow morning early," he said. "Jesus, Lucas, you know what time it is?" "Yeah, I'm looking at a clock. It's 2:10. You got a pen?"
"Just a minute."
A minute later, she said,
"Go ahead."
"I need you to go back to Arnold's house. Get an Addison cop to go with you if you need to. Look at his guitar. It's got a weird checkerboard top to it. I want you to see if there's a manufacturer's name on it. Arnold called it by some name. Had something to do with parts."
"Partscaster."
"Right. Like a Stratocaster. He said Poole built it out of parts. I want to know where he got the parts. When you find that out, I want you to track down the company and find out what Dallas addresses they've shipped parts to, especially addresses which have ordered parts a number of times to build entire guitars."
"I can do that. But you think this might have waited until the morning?" she asked.
"Nah, I get up late and wanted to get an early start on this. You get up early so you can get started without me."
"Listen, waxworks.
I'm tired now, so I'm going to sleep. I'll call you when I wake up," Lucas said.
"Listen."
Lucas hung up, turned out the lights, grinned in the dark, and fell asleep. He slept like a baby until 9:12. Ray still felt groggy when her alarm went off at 5:45.
She'd usually do a half-hour workout before cleaning up, but decided to skip it and get moving. Bob was also an early riser, so she called him, found him awake but not out of bed yet.
"That fucking Davenport called me at 2 a.m. and gave me a job," she told Bob. "I figure if I have to start early, I might as well make you miserable, too."
"Did you take it lying down, or did you show a little gumption?"
"Lying down. Besides, he had a good idea," she said. "I'll knock on your door in 20 minutes.
The Dallas morning was crisp and cool, with the nice smooth feeling that a hot place gets at night. Not quite real autumn in Texas. Not yet. Ray drove, Bob yawning next to her, and they swung through a Starbucks for coffee.
"So what do you think of Lucas?" Ray asked when they were back in the car again.
She'd told Bob about looking Lucas up on the internet and what she'd found.
"He's a smart guy," Bob said, "and he likes the pressure. You know that thing about getting too close to the fire and you'll get burnt? He's already been burnt a few times, and I believe deep down in his little black heart, he likes it, likes the action. He's been chasing pool for less than a full week, and he's already been in 2 shootouts."
"Yeah, we gotta think about that," she said, sipping at her latte.
"I've already thought about it," Bob said.
"What do you conclude?"
"He's like us," Bob said. "If he doesn't get killed, or get one of us killed, he could be somebody you could hang out with."
"A friend, you think?"
"Something like that.
Maybe.
At least you've got somebody to play basketball with. I'm interested in seeing how that's gonna work out. Is he gonna get tougher with me, like really tough, or is he gonna back off a bit? Not polite exactly, but you know, try to finesse me."
"I don't know," Bob said.
"What are you gonna do?"
"I'm gonna try to cut his heart out," Ray said. "But I don't know if I'll get it done."
The traffic wasn't bad going across town. They got behind a car with a bumper sticker that said, "Old and Retired," and, in smaller letters, "Go Around Me." They did. They were at Derek Arnold's place by 7 o'clock, met by an Addison cop who had a key. They went inside, found that it had been thoroughly scrubbed and smelled of industrial-strength lemon-scented bleach. The bird was missing, and the cop said it had been picked up by the local Humane Society. The guitar was where Ray had first seen it, sitting next to its amp. They examined it inch by inch and found several different brand names on the bridge, the tuning machines, and pickups. All those looked specific to the parts, though. Then Bob spotted the guitar case, which had been stuck in a closet, and inside, the papers for the guitar, including the guarantees for all the parts and also guarantees on the body parts from Pootie Parts of Indianapolis, Indiana.
"That's what we need," Bob said. He looked at his watch.
"Too early. The place won't be open yet. How about some breakfast?"
On the recommendation of the Addison cop, they drove out to the Rayason Diner, ordered pancakes, Ray, and waffles, Bob, and eventually got a phone call through a man named Cy Wynn, who said he was the owner and sole employee of Pootie Parts. Pootie himself was dead. Ray told Wynn, "What we need is addresses for people from Dallas who bought parts from you."
"I'd be happy to give them to you, but my computer record system isn't exactly fast," Wynn said. "It could take a while to search through a few hundred names at least, in a place as big as Dallas."
They were on Ray's speakerphone, and Bob said, "This would probably be a repeat customer, not a one-off. Might have bought a bunch of stuff from you. As we understand it, this guy built quite a few guitars."
"That'd narrow it down," Wynn said. "You know what brand name he sold them under?"
"There's really nothing on the guitar like a brand name. He supposedly hand-carved and hand-painted the tops and backs. The one we saw had this kind of distorted checkerboard on it, wrapping around the back where it narrowed down and twisted into a painted hole. "Oh, sure, that's Chuck Wiggin," Wynne said. "Like Chuck Wagon, but W-I-G-G-I-N. He does good work, mostly on Les Paul, Telly, and Strat replicas. He's not in trouble, is he?" "You got a name and address?" Ray asked. "Yeah, sure, let me look at my Rolodex." While he was doing that, Ray muttered to Bob, "He doesn't have a computer." Bob nodded. "Probably the last guy in the country with an actual Rolodex." Wynne was back in 30 seconds and read off the address where he'd been shipping guitar parts. Easy as that. Lucas came to the door in his shorts and T-shirt, yawning, scratching his stomach. Somebody had started banging on the door at 9:12. He peeked through the door crack, saw Ray, and said, "I probably ought to put on some pants." "You ain't gonna impress me one way or the other," Ray said. "Okay, come on in. I'll go put on some pants anyway." He yawned again, leaving the door open behind him, and asked as he walked away, "Find anything?" "Yeah, we got Poole's address," Bob said. Lucas turned and looked from one to the other. They weren't laughing, though they might have looked a little smug. "Now I really need my pants," he said. Lucas heard this story, then called Fort in Washington. "We've got an address for Poole. Haven't looked at it yet, but it apparently was good 3 months ago." "Do not go there," Fort said. "I got SOG on speed dial. Got a couple of SOG guys with me now. I know all about Bob and Ray, and I think three more deputies and a couple of technical people would be about right. Listen, this isn't about some dim-witted gun freak. This guy can shoot and has proven he's willing to do it. You sit there, I'll get an SOG team to you before noon." Lucas told Bob and Ray about Fort's decision, and they both nodded, and Bob said, "He's right. Get a big enough team, and it's a lot safer than some knock-on-the-door small city detective shit." "One thing we have to consider, Poole may know we're here," Lucas said. "His folks were tortured to death, and Darling might be down here after the dope guys tried to grab his wife, and TV's been all over the Arnold murder. He'll know it's the cartel. He'll know about me, too, from Darling. If Janice Darling was lying about him not having a phone, and I believe she was, he might have already run." "I ought to cruise the place," Ray said. "Get an old car from some crappy rental place. Colored girl with a do-rag. He'd see me as a maid." "We'd piss off Fort," Lucas said. He thought about that for a moment, then said, "What the hell? He needs to get used to it. The sooner the better." "Let's go," Bob said. "Hot damn, we're cooking with gas." "Another saying from 1945, Ray said to Lucas. "The stump collects them." They found the right car near the airport at Scratch and Dent Rentals, and a half hour after they talked to Fort, Ray was squeezing herself into a Toyota Corolla with 110,000 miles on the clock. The rental agent guaranteed that it would get through the day at $20 a day, not including gas. Lucas and Bob trailed her toward the address they'd gotten from Wynne at Pooty Parts, and a minute out of the target found themselves driving through a low-income shopping area. Bob said, "I got a bad feeling about this," Lucas said. "Uh-huh." A minute later, Ray called and said, "The address is a mail drop. You post him." "We're coming in to talk," Lucas said. They sat in the Jeep outside You Post Him, arguing about the next step. Eventually, Ray went inside to see if she could wheedle a legitimate address for Chuck Wiggin out of the clerk. The clerk was willing to cooperate, but didn't have the information. Ray returned to the Jeep and told Lucas and Bob about her talk with the clerk. "He says if they made their customers give them an address and a phone number, they wouldn't have any customers. He looked at me like I was retarded for asking. No chance that he's an alarm, that he's calling pool right now? I don't think so, she said. I'd believe him about not having the records, and if he doesn't have records, why should pool give him one? Bob said. Yeah. Lucas called Fort. That SOG thing? Never mind. What happened? I decided Ray should cruise the place in a junker car. Turned out to be a mail drop. Damn it, I could taste the guy. When Lucas was off the phone, Ray asked, Now what? We know he's around here, Lucas said. We have to think. Is there any way we could get at a public record that would take us to him? Anything at all? They drove back to the hotel and sat around and thought, and called Fort and got him thinking about it. How they could possibly use a telephone, gas company, or power company bill to track down Poole's house. The problem being, he's not living there as Garvin Pool, Ray said. He's got a lot of money, and for $1,000 you can get a perfectly good Texas driver's license under any name you want, if you know the right guy. We know he probably came here about 5 years ago, Lucas said. Wonder if he bought a house, assuming he lives somewhere around his mail drop. Wonder how many houses sold in this area 5 years ago. Thousands, Bob said. People were pouring in here like rats around a Pizza Hut dumpster. Besides, I don't think he bought a house, ties up too much money, and the realtors look at you too close. What I bet is, he found a house to rent and had a quiet talk with the owner. He says, no lease, we'll pay you $3,000 a month, and if the tax man asks us, we'll tell him we pay you $1,500. That's what he did. You may be right, Lucas said, but that doesn't get us any closer to Pool. Ray started talking about checking Texas driver's licenses with a face recognition computer at the FBI, but Lucas was skeptical. He's got a beard and wears eyeglasses, and the pictures are probably pretty shitty. We'll get 20,000 false positives. Bob eventually was the one who had an idea that worked. He'd been in the bathroom taking a leak, came out and said, That took some pressure off my brain. Look, we're thinking too much about right now, but if he's lived there for 5 years, I wouldn't be surprised if he had a hardwired phone at the beginning. Most people did. We ought to go back 5 years with everybody we know who knew him and look at their phone records, see who they called in Dallas. Can we do that? Lucas asked. He really didn't know. Depends on the phone company. AT&T keeps the records for something like 7 years. Verizon and Sprint don't keep them so long, but they keep them for a few years. What I'm thinking is, Box was close to her uncle. She even risked going to his funeral, when a lot of people there knew who she was and the fact that the cops wanted to talk to her. I say, let's look at the uncle's phone records. They called Washington, and Fort said, Yeah, we can do that. You got a name for the uncle, address, whatever? They had some of it, and Fort said he could get the rest. Nothing was going to happen for a while, and they eventually drove to a half-priced books and browsed for an hour. Lucas bought a book that told him how to match his personal coloring to the colors of his menswear. Bob bought a book on Leica cameras, and Ray found one on Latin American art. Now I feel like the dumb shit in the bunch, which definitely isn't the case, Lucas said as they checked out. You sure about that? Ray asked. Who gets you business class airplane tickets? You've got a point, Bob said to Ray. For God's sakes, don't piss him off. On the way back to the hotel, Fort called. Tell Bob he's a genius. We got an old number in Dallas with Time Warner Cable, but it's still working. It goes back to a month after the Chattanooga armored car shootings for a Marvin tune. That's him, Lucas said, and you're a genius, Bob. I knew that, Bob said. I'll crank up the SOG team again, Fort said. Hold on until we cruise it. We've still got Ray's rent-a-wreck, Lucas said. Call me, Fort said. Ray said, Marvin Tune. Makes me laugh. They all do that, guys on the run, Lucas said. Pick out a name that sounds sort of like their own. If he'd changed his name to Bob and somebody called his name, he might not react like a normal Bob. No such thing as a normal Bob, Ray said. You got me there, Bob said. But we knew all that anyway, Ray told Lucas. I was laughing because of the tune thing. You know, a guitar maker picking out a name like Tune. Didn't see that, Lucas admitted. Maybe you are smarter than me, and we already know Bob's a genius. Could be onto something, Ray said. The Target house was in the neighborhood called Preston Hollow, homes ranging from nice to jaw-dropping on quiet leafy streets north of Dallas's downtown. Bob rode with Lucas in the Jeep, while Ray put the do-rag back on her head and followed them in. When they were a block away, Lucas pulled to the side of the street and watched as Ray cruised the house. She had her telephone set on speaker and told them, Nice house, but not one of the best. Two-car garage. Got a fence around the backyard, and I think I can see another small building back there. A studio or something. Nothing in the driveway. Nothing moving inside that I can see. Gonna loop the block. They watched as she did a U-turn two blocks away and came back toward them. Can't see much. Old guy across the street came out for his mail. He's going back inside now. They watched as she turned into a driveway across from the Marvin Tune house. Lucas asked, What the hell are you doing? Applying for a housekeeping job. Ray said on the phone. She's being Ray, Bob said. Lucas. For Christ's sakes, Ray said. Shut up now, I'm carrying the phone. They heard her knocking on the door and then a man's rusty voice.
Yes? What can I do for you, missy?
Sir, I'm a U.S. Marshal, and don't tell me I don't look like one because I know that. We are doing research on the house across the street, a Mr. Marvin Tune.
Don't know him. Never heard of him, the man said.
The man right across the street, she pointed.
Name isn't Marvin anything. It's William Robb. Will. You got the wrong address.
I have a photograph here. Lucas and Bob couldn't see it, but envisioned Ray pulling out the most recent mugshot they had, printed on a piece of 8x10 paper. The rusty voice said,
Well, that's Will, all right. He's older, and he's been growing out a beard the last few weeks, but yeah, that's him. I can tell you that he and Laura had a friend come in yesterday. Big kind of pickup with double tires on the back, whatever you call those.
Dually, Ray said.
Yeah. And the friends stayed over, and this morning they were tearing around in their two pickups, and they had some furniture loaded in one. Looked to me like they were moving out.
Yes, have they been back? Ray asked.
Not that I've seen. They have three cars. Well, two cars and a pickup. And they left the pickup somewhere, and then they pulled out in two cars and the visitor's pickup. Exactly what did they do?
We're not sure he did anything. But if you have any way to reach them, don't do it, Ray said.
I don't, except for walking across the street and knocking on the door. Are you sure you're a marshal?
Absolutely. I'm going to walk away now and across the street. Please don't come outside until I wave at you. Lucas and Bob saw her walk to the driveway, get in her car, and then she told them, I'm going to knock on Poole's door. I'm 99% sure that they're gone.
Don't do that, Lucas said. We need to talk about it first.
I'm gonna do what I'm gonna do, Ray said. Might as well get used to it.
Bob looked at Lucas and said, Really? Get used to it?
Ray backed her car out of the driveway, backed far enough down the street that she could pull into the Target house, got out and said, "I'm doing it," and they heard her banging on the door. "No answer," she said. "There's a slot in the front drapes." She moved sideways and looked in a window and said, "Looks like a lot of furniture is missing." "I'm coming out," Lucas said. "Okay, we've got a reasonable ID from that old man, whoever he was, and a telephone number. That ought to be enough for a judge. Got a mass murderer and a baby killer and a cop killer ought to be good enough for anybody," Bob said. "Call your man in Washington and see how fast he can get a warrant." They had the warrant in an hour, delivered by two Texas Rangers who brought a crime scene team with them. Chapter 18. When Court fled from the townhouse shooting scene, she hadn't done anything clever, because she wasn't a clever woman. After turning a couple of corners, she ran straight south as fast as she reasonably could to I-695 and got lost in the traffic. She'd picked that up from Soto. Getting out is almost always the best thing to do. There are more eyes around than you know, and if you try to hide, somebody will see you. She'd freaked herself out by shooting Soto, though she didn't regret it. She'd changed hotels, and that night she'd driven carefully out into the countryside and had thrown the black rifle in a roadside slough. She thought she'd done the right thing. The federal marshals would know that she and Soto had killed Poole's parents, the Bennetts, and Arnold, and Bedsoe, the old guy in Roswell, Georgia. And Soto had told her he'd give up anybody and everything to avoid the needle. Would the boss accept that? She didn't know. She sweated it out for 20 hours, all the possibilities. Court wasn't sophisticated in the ways of the world, but she'd seen mafia and cartel movies and accepted the movie premise that organized crime was like a huge FBI or CIA, that they would find you everywhere, that they had eyes on every street corner and every bar. She could imagine somebody dropping a quarter in a payphone and saying, "I found that broad you've been looking for." Ridiculous. But she didn't know it. 20 hours after the shooting, she'd decided that honesty would be the best policy. She had a phone number that she had written on a piece of cardboard that she kept in a wallet. It was 15 digits long, all that would fit on the cardboard to disguise the starting point. She'd never used the number herself. Soto had always done the calling. But now she lay on her stomach on the hotel bed and punched the number into her last burner and quickly hung up. Lay with her eyes closed for 10 minutes, choking with fear. No choice. She dialed it again, and a man answered on the second ring.
"See? Soto died. Is this the lady who travels with him?"
"Yes."
"I will pass the message. Is this phone good?"
"First time burner," Court said.
"We will call you back at this number in less than 1 hour."
In less than 1 hour, a different man called back, and she thought it was the boss himself, the soft remote voice, the electronic hum in the background.
"Tell me." "On the phone?" Court asked. "It's safe enough."
She told him all of it. She'd been wounded, that they had tracked the marshals, and therefore Poole, to Dallas. That they'd been sucked into a trap set by the marshals. That Soto had been caught. That Soto had told her that he would give up everything to avoid execution. That she thought it best that he not be given the chance. There was no possibility that she could take him away from marshals armed with machine guns, so she'd shot him. They'd been close to Poole, but now she didn't know what to do. When she finished, the man asked, "Where are you now?" "A Holiday Inn." She found the address on a room card and gave it to him.
You waited to call us.
I was afraid and running, and I had things to do, things to get rid of, she said.
Listen, lady, you've done very well. I am impressed. Stay where you are. Some more ladies will come to see you today, the boss said. Throw the telephone away and get a new one. When you get one, call this number, let it ring once, and then hang up.
I can do that.
Before she finished, the connection went dead. Box, Poole, and Darling were still in Denton, walking around the shopping center. Darling wanted to get out of Texas.
If the marshals are looking for us, they'll have brought in the local cops and probably the state cops, too, he said. But cops get screwed up when they have to cross state lines. Bureaucratic bullshit gets them tangled up. Poole asked, what are you thinking?
We ought to run up to Oklahoma. We can be there in an hour. Maybe get a motel in Ardmore. We can sit around and think about it for a day or two.
Poole looked at Box, who nodded.
Makes sense to me, she said.
They left Denton, continuing straight north on I-35, a three-vehicle caravan. Crossed the state line, and a little more than an hour later, checked into three separate rooms at a Comfort Suites. Three separate rooms in case the cops found one of them, they'd have a fast temporary refuge in two others. They met in Poole's room, talked about the situation for a while, then Box said she wanted to get some decent food and went out to find a supermarket. As the door closed behind her, Poole asked Darling,
what are the chances of somebody randomly spotting us here, on our faces?
Darling shrugged. Slim to none. You've never had a beard before now that I've seen, and your ID is good. Nobody knows my face anyway. Nobody knows the tags on your vehicles, and they won't find them by looking up the name you used on the house. I've always had a couple spare sets of tags, and I put one on my truck as soon as I got out of Alabama.
Poole thought about that for a few seconds, then said, I'm dry as hell. Let's take my car and find us a couple of beers.
Saw an Applebee's coming in, Darling said.
They drove a couple of minutes to an Applebee's, got a booth in a corner away from other patrons, ordered a steak and beer for Poole and fish and chips and a beer for Darling, and Poole said,
Sturgill, I know you have fun with your shit-kicker acts, but you're the smartest guy I know. I gotta run, I know that. But I don't know where to run to. Dora thinks Florida, but I got this feeling that Florida's one place the marshals might look. The cartel boys, too. What do you think? Someplace further on south? I don't speak Spanish, and the cartels carry a lot of weight down there.
The waitress brought their beers, and they both took a swallow, and when she was gone, Darling put his elbows on the table, leaned forward, and said,
You want my opinion, and I don't think you'll like it. I'd say Edmonton or Calgary, up in Canada.
Poole opened his mouth to protest, but Darling put up a finger to slow him down, then said,
Listen, those places got more than a million people each. You can get lost in them. Edmonton has this shopping mall that's got something like 1,000 stores in it. It's bigger than AT&T Stadium. Get out of here.
Poole tried to catch a Cowboys game at least once a year. AT&T Stadium was the biggest building he'd ever seen, much less been in.
I'm serious. Edmonton is an oil town. All kinds of people coming and going all the time. Lots of Americans all over the place, including oil workers from the South, Texas, Louisiana. Nobody will give your accent a second thought. It's actually kind of like Dallas, except for the winter.
Freeze my fucking ass off, Poole said.
You get used to it, Darling said. You spend most of the winter indoors, and you're really only talking about a couple of years until things cool down here in the States. How would I get across the border? I can fix that, Darling said. I know a guy, honest to God, smuggles stolen heavy equipment across the Minnesota border into Ontario. Getting you across the border would be nothing. Take your pickup if you want. Canada, Poole rubbed the side of his face. Jesus, I gotta think about that. Think about speaking the language, Darling said. That's a big deal. If you don't know the language, you've got to rely on somebody else for everything. How do you know so much about this? Poole asked. 'Cause if I ever have to run, that's where I'm going, Darling said. Canada. I worked through all of this years ago with Janice. We have money stashed up there and a couple of good IDs for each of us. The food came, and when the waitress had gone again, Poole asked, How about Phoenix or Vegas? If I had to choose, I'd say Phoenix. That's another place with a lot of tourists going through. People moving in and out all the time, and it doesn't have the surveillance that Vegas does. Vegas has a million cameras all over the place, and I gotta believe that the feds monitor the video feeds with their face recognition technology. That place is like a sump hole for old mafia guys. Okay, not Vegas. How about California? About a billion cops, Darling said. You move there, you'll have 50 government workers looking at you, checking your tax records, asking where you moved there from, where you work now, how long you've been there. California is like a Nazi state with palm trees. Papers, please. Seriously, I've looked into all of this. Ah, shit. You got another problem, Darling said. I don't want you to get pissed when I say it. Dora, Darling twitched a finger at him. You've been thinking about it. Yeah. If they're looking for faces, hers is distinctive. She's pretty, and lots of guys look her over, including cops. If I stay with her, spotting her could mean spotting me. I didn't want to mention it when she's around. Poole ate silently until his steak was nearly gone, then said, You know, I'll take the chance with Dora. I'm not leaving her behind. People get to know me. They don't like me. I can feel it. Dora knows me, and she still likes me. I like you, Darling said. And I like you, Poole said. But we are rare people. I mean, what would you do without your wife and kids? Who would your friends be? Darling looked out the window at the parking lot, then shook his head. I don't know. I'd be pretty goddamn lonely. So we're stuck with what we got and who we are, Poole said. That's what we got to work with. Darling chewed on his lower lip for a few seconds, then looked across at Poole and said, You can't walk away from Dora, but you could shoot that little girl. Poole said, Yeah, well, I don't know what that is. I guess it means that I'll take care of me and mine, but I don't so much give a shit about anyone else. You yell for help, I'll come, no questions. Some stranger catches on fire. I wouldn't walk across the street to piss on him. That night they got together in Box's room and ate roast beef sandwiches she'd bought at a supermarket and argued about their next move. Darling mentioned Edmonton, and when Box found out where it was, she shook her head. No way in hell, she said. My uncle was somewhere up there during the Cold War at a radar station. He said it got dark in November and didn't get light until March. Even if I could handle the cold, which I couldn't,
I couldn't handle all that dark. I'm a southern girl.
They ran again through the other possibilities. Arizona, California, Florida. Darling even mentioned the possibility of simply moving 30 or 40 miles over to Fort Worth or down to Houston or San Antonio. You've already got a few good sets of Texas IDs. You wouldn't have to go through that routine again. Getting new ones in Arizona, getting new tags and all that, Darling said.
Wasn't that big a problem, Poole said. You got these illegals coming across the border. There's a whole industry out there making good phony IDs. The guy I got my Texas IDs from could probably get us good Arizona IDs.
Texas is too scary now, especially since we've left the house. I think it's Arizona, Buck said. That's good with me.
Poole turned to Darling. You think you're still okay in Alabama, and I know you're anxious to get going up to Canada. Got to go, Darling said. I need the alibi if the feds come around again.
Could you go with us to Arizona? Poole asked. You and me in your truck? I'm thinking you got that hideout spot in your camper back. I've got $3 million in cash and $1.5 million in gold I gotta hide. If the cops pull me over, what is it? 2 days' drive down there? I can do that, Darling said.
What about me? Box asked.
I need you in a different car, Poole said. I'm going to put some of the gold and cash under your spare tire. If something happens to me and Sturge, you'll still be outside with some resources.
Later in bed, Poole said,
We'll drive separate routes down to Arizona. You drive 5 miles over the speed limit all the way. Don't attract any attention. Don't take a drink, not a single fucking cocktail. I don't want you blowing a 12 and having the cops taking the car apart.
Box nodded and asked,
Where are we going, exactly?
Can't tell you that yet. I gotta go on the internet and do some research. After we get there, we'll get a decent motel and lay up for a while, check out the situation. Find someplace nice, quiet, white, maybe a little older. Rent a house, settle in.
Sounds right, she said. Could we get together at night along the way?
He shook his head. I'll be driving a different route. I don't want them spotting you, tracking you, then spotting me, and vice versa. I think we're okay, but I don't want to take any chances. That's why we'll split up the money. If something happens to one of us, the other one's still outside and has some cash to maneuver with.
Right now, we got one car too many, Box said.
I'll drive it back to Dallas tomorrow, store it with the truck.
You know what? Box asked. I'd feel better driving the truck. Would you mind?
No, that'd be fine.
Maybe I'll put a couple pieces of furniture in it, she said.
Poole laughed and then said,
That's not a bad idea, actually. Antique lady out scouting around. Cops won't give you a second look.
When do we go?
Well, Sturgill's getting antsy about going up to Canada, Poole said.
I'd say tomorrow morning, early.
I'm scared, she said.
I'm a little tense myself, Poole said. But what it is what it is.
She looked at the clock and said,
I'm going to sleep with you overnight, but I'll go mess up the bed in my room before we leave, so it looks slept in.
Why don't we make this one look fucked in? Poole asked.
Good with me, Buck said.
As Poole, Box, and Darling worked through their next move, Court spent a lot of time pacing. Lying face up on the motel bed was still painful.
Face down, she couldn't see the TV, which was rattling along endlessly about the upcoming election, and she was too cranked to watch it anyway. She still had a Ruger 357 with a belt clip, and she got it, loaded it, and clipped it to the back of her sweatpants and pulled her sweatshirt over it. The weight of the gun caused her pants to sag, but that was the least of her worries. What to do when the other ladies showed up? If they came in with guns, court wouldn't go easy, but she thought she'd probably go. Made her cry thinking about it. Life so far had been one long roll in the shit. The only thing she really liked about it was using her tools. The surge of pleasure and power she got from torture was as addictive as methamphetamine. She went out only once, bought a pay-as-you-go burner phone, made the one-ring call to the secret number, and stopped at a pancake house where she bought a double stack of buttermilk pancakes with link sausages, ate until she felt nauseous. The knock on the door came at mid-afternoon. She was lying face down on the bed, listening to CNN, and the knock made her jump. She slid off the bed, pulled her sweatshirt down, smacked her lips a couple of times, pushed her hair back, went to the door, and said, "Yes?" A woman's voice. "Open up, it's us." Us turned out to be two women, late 30s or early 40s, thin and tough like beef jerky, short hair, one blonde, one brunette, small gold earrings and ink, tattoos running up and down their exposed lower arms and legs, peeking out of the V of their blouses. The taller of the two had a triangle of three crude ink dots on her right cheek next to her eye. Some kind of secret prison symbol, Court thought. The short one asked, "You got a gun?"
"Yeah." "Well, don't shoot us," she said.
"My name's Annie. My partner here is Rosalind, Rosie. We're not here to hurt you."
"Then what are you here for?" Court asked.
"To help out," Rosie said. "We don't have all the details, but the boss wants his money back. We understand that you've run into some feds along the way." Court backed away from the door, but kept her hand on her hip close to the revolver, and the two women stepped inside. They looked around the room, then Rosie took the office chair at the small desk, and Annie settled into the one easy chair. Court said,
"I can't sit so well. I got shot in the buttocks."
"So we heard," Annie said. "You never got it fixed?"
"We fixed it ourselves," Court said. "Cut a bullet out with a razor blade. Bled like crazy."
She told them the whole story of the wound, and when she was done, the two women looked at each other, some silent agreement between them, and Rosie said, "You got some major balls, honey. How's the penicillin working for you?"
"I still hurt, but I don't see any infection," Court said.
Annie said, "We got some OxyContin out in the RV. I'll get you some."
"Rosie, let's do that first.
Then you tell us about these guys we're looking for, and the marshals."
Chapter 19. Lucas, Bob, and Ray broke into the house through the front door, because that looked like the least used, and so the least likely to have fresh prints. The three of them walked through first, clearing the place, with a variety of Texas cops waiting outside. And as they worked through the house, Lucas realized that Poole was gone. There was still furniture inside, but it seemed that several pieces were missing, leaving behind leg indentations on the carpets. While there was still some clothing in the closets, it seemed to him that the good stuff was gone. No new men's shoes, lots of old, dusty-looking Nikes, and no women's shoes at all. Lucas looked under the sink and found some garbage topped by a banana peel and moist coffee grounds. He looked in the master bedroom suite, and the bathroom cabinets were mostly empty.
Bob and Ray had gone to check the garage and a backyard shed while Lucas was poking around the kitchen and bedroom. The garage was empty except for a well-used lawnmower. So was the shed. Ray said, "It looked like he used to have a lot of tools and stuff, but they're all gone. There's a homemade workbench in there and a trash bin with a broken guitar neck in it. Gotta be the right guy." "Didn't miss them by much," Lucas said. "A few hours at the most."
"How do you know?"
Bob asked. "Banana peel and coffee grounds," Lucas said.
"Huh."
"There was a banana peel on top of the garbage. Looked good as new."
"How long does that last?"
"Not even overnight, I don't think."
"I bet it was dropped in there this morning. The coffee grounds were still wet."
"Well, shit," Bob said. "If you were really a genius, you'd have thought of that old telephone thing yesterday," Ray said to Bob.
One of the crime scene crew people came out and said, "They didn't wipe anything. There are fingerprints all over the place, and hair and everything else. Sexual residue on the sheets."
"Get the prints going," Ray said. "If you get good ones, we'll have confirmation in a couple of hours."
"We can get good ones."
They eventually went out to the back of the house to a gas barbecue and a wooden picnic table. They sat at the table, and Bob said,
"DNA will get us confirmations both on the murders in Biloxi and the armored car job."
"Take a few days on the DNA," Lucas said. "I'll be happy with a good set of prints right now."
"So they're running, and we've got at least 3 fake IDs," Ray said. "Let's see if Poole has a driver's license under any of those names, and if he does, see if we can link it up to some license tags."
Lucas nodded and took out his phone. "Gotta get Fort on the computer shit. And Ray, grab one of those rangers and see what they can get out of the Texas DMV. Fort was pleased.
"Man, you got them on the run. Get me those prints."
One of the rangers ran down the property ownership. It wasn't Poole, and got in touch with the owner, who showed up 2 hours after they broke through the front door. He was a heavy-set man, red-faced, with a belly that bulged over his turquoise and silver belt buckle. He parked his Lincoln on the street, then wandered over to a ranger who brought him to Lucas.
"What the hell is going on here?" he asked, and, "You busted down my door?"
The ranger said to Lucas,
"This is Mr. Carlton, Davis Carlton. He's the homeowner."
"We're looking for a fugitive named Garvin Poole," Lucas said.
"This ain't no Garvin Poole," Carlton said. "This here is a man named of Will Robb."
Lucas showed him the mugshot and he scratched his head and said,
"Damn, that sure looks like Will."
He'd rented the house to a man he knew as William Robb, he said, and he didn't know why the phone would be in the name of a Marvin tune.
"I didn't pay for a phone or have anything to do with it," he said.
He collected $2,000 a month from the man he called Robb and said that Robb had told him that he was a disabled veteran who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan and was living on a government disability pension from having breathed in poisonous gas.
"Pretty nice house for $2,000," Ray remarked.
Carlton flushed and said,
"He was a war hero. I gave him a break on the rent."
"That's real patriotic of you," Ray said.
Carlton had no idea what kind of vehicles Robb and his wife owned, except that one was a white pickup.
"He'd drop the rent off at my office. That's the only time I ever saw the man. I came by every 6 months or so to check on the property, and there was never a problem. They seemed like a real nice couple. Kind of renters you hope for."
When Carlton left, everything slowed down. There was no record of a Marvin Toon or a Chuck Charles Wiggin with the DMV, although there were several William Robbs. Lucas called Fort to get him working on Dallas-area William Robbs, but told the others, won't be one of them. I can feel it. Fake names are cheap, like burner phones, Bob said. They got a different one for everything. Phones and names. God damn it, Lucas said. We need to get on these guys. In 12 hours of driving, Texas speeds, they could be 1,000 miles from here. By tomorrow night, they could be in California or Florida, and we'll be starting all over. Tell me what to do, and I'll do it, Ray said. Lucas scratched his cheek, looked blankly at the back fence, then said, Well, first, go change into some Marshall clothes. Then we all knock on doors, talk to neighbors. We can at least find out what kind of vehicles they're driving and what color they are. I got the old guy across the street, Ray said. He seems like a curtain peeker. There were 5 properties that touched pools, one on each side, one directly behind, and 2 at the back corners. 3 more houses across the street had a straight look at the driveway going back to the garage. Nobody in any of the houses had useful information, including the old guy across the street. Rob, they said, had a gray car, or maybe dark blue. His wife had a black convertible, and they also had a white pickup, a Ford. Then a teenager who'd heard the cops were looking for information about Rob's car came down and told them that it was a metallic gray 5-liter Mustang, less than a year old. A beautiful car, he said, and Rob's pride and joy. And Rob was a cool guy, played a mean guitar. All of which added up to slightly more than nothing. Fort called. You got him. The prints are a direct hit. Garvin Poole and Dora Box. We knew that, but good to know for sure, Lucas said. Trouble is, by now they could be 200 miles from here. The crime scene people were still working the house, and Lucas, Bob, and Ray were standing in the driveway comparing notes when the old guy from across the street came ambling over. He had a furry white mustache and clear blue eyes. Ray said, Mr. Case, how are you doing? You said if I thought of anything, let you know. I thought of something, Case said. Yeah? He pointed across the street to the house next to his. It was an imposing place, faux colonial with white pillars hovering over a circular front drive. That's the Smith place. Talked to them 2 hours ago, Bob said. They tell you about the wedding last year? Bob, Ray, and Lucas exchanged glances. Hard to tell where this might be going. Ray asked, The wedding? Their daughter got married. About time, in my opinion. She was getting long in the tooth and had sort of passed herself around town. But that's neither here nor there. They got married down at St. John's, and then they had a reception out to the country club, and then they had an at-home pool thing for members of the wedding party. He pointed again at the Smith house and the circular drive. The wedding party was all in limos, maybe 10, 12 black limos, and they all came up that circular driveway. One at a time, 2 or 3 minutes apart. All the people were getting out, kissing each other, going inside. A wedding photographer was out taking movies of them coming up and getting out of the cars. Bob said, Yeah? Lucas said, The cameras were looking across the street to this driveway. The old man jabbed a finger at Lucas. Bingo! They didn't invite me to the wedding, but they invited me over to the at-home reception because they thought I was lonely, my wife being gone, and also because they planned to play loud rock music all night and they didn't want me complaining to the police. I was standing there on the porch watching them make the movies, and I distinctly remember Will Robb coming and going in his truck. Bob said, I'll go get the movies. And headed across the street at a trot. Ray said, Mr. Case, you are a sweetheart. Bob did eventually get the movies, but it wasn't all that simple. At first, the Smiths weren't at home anymore, but Case told them that Emily Smith was a realtor and they managed to locate her. She came home and gave them a compact disc with the wedding movies on it. And watching on the Smiths' high-resolution television, they could see license plates on Poole's white pickup, but the movies were not quite steady enough to make out the numbers. The plates were white, so almost certainly from Texas. Bob and Ray wanted to send the movies to the FBI's digital imaging experts in Washington, but Lucas suggested that they first try the wedding photographer. The photographer wasn't working that day, but agreed to meet them at his studio. He turned out to be a short, stout, solemn-looking man who dressed all in black, including a black fedora and a black string tie with an onyx slide. He brought the movies up on a computer screen, grabbed several frames of each instance where the license tags appeared, and began enhancing them in Photoshop. The numbers never did get particularly clear, but enough numbers were clear enough in the different frames that by putting several frames together, they pieced out a good tag number. If the FBI has the capabilities that they're rumored to have, they should be able to get them a lot clearer, the photographer told them. But remember this, I hold the copyright on these photos, not the Smiths. You can use them, but you can't publish them. I don't want to see these on TV. You're being less generous than you might be, Ray observed. I gotta eat. If somebody's gonna put them out to the TV stations, it's gonna be me, and I'm gonna get paid. Don't do it without talking to us first, Lucas said. If you put them out there and the suspects see them, they'll ditch the plates and we'll come bust you for interfering with a federal investigation and maybe accessory after the fact. I'll talk to my attorney about that. Sure, do that, Lucas said. If he needs further clarification, tell him to call me. Back in the car, Lucas called the rangers at the Poole Robb house, gave them the tag number, and they promised to wallpaper the entire state with it, and all the adjacent states. Lucas warned the rangers that the people in the truck were armed and willing to kill. So are we, the ranger said. Before you do that, kill them. I'd like to talk to them, Lucas said. We'll do what we can, the ranger said. I'm making no promises. When Lucas was off the phone, Bob asked, What are the chances? We're maybe 50-50 to get a hit, Lucas said. How many white Ford trucks in Texas?
About a billion, give or take.
On their way back to the house, a crime scene cop called from the townhouses where Soto had been shot.
We picked up a lot of brass from the .223 used to kill Soto. Most of it had been polished clean, but we found two almost identical thumbprints on two cartridges. We got back a solid hit for a Charlene Marie Court. The feds have no other record of her other than a couple of speeding tickets given to a woman with that name in Florida.
If there was no other record, where did her prints come from? Lucas asked.
The feds had them, but they were submitted as part of a background check by a security guard company in Tallahassee 8 years ago. That's all we know.
And we don't know whether this Court actually was the shooter or whether she just handled the ammo at some point, Lucas said.
No, we don't. But the ammo with the prints is identical to the ammo that had been polished, and the prints look to us to be fresh. They're very clear. They're not interrupted by scratches or rubs that you'd expect if the shells had been handled a lot. If the shells are polished, we figure there can only be a bad reason for that. It's what you expect from a really careful hold-up guy or a professional shooter, like this Soto guy. Somebody else might not be so careful, pressing a cartridge down into a magazine.
Okay, I get that, Lucas said. And since the other person is a woman, and Charlene Marie Court certainly sounds like a woman, yes, we think you should look up Charlene Marie Court. Lucas called Fort and gave him the name. Now we wait, Lucas said. Hope there's a lot of football on TV.
Could be some intense hoops back at the hotel, Ray said.
Could be, Lucas said. Bob was shaking his head.
Something's going to happen, he said. We got momentum. Either this court is going to turn up or we'll get a hit on the plates.
From your mouth to God's ears, Ray said.
Chapter 20 Dora Box woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning, listened to Poole breathing beside her. They'd gone to bed early.
Sturgill Darling always went to bed early, being a farmer.
And now she was wide awake, alert, ready to go. She lay as still as she could for 5 minutes, then crept out of bed in the dark, got dressed, went to the door, and peeked out. Nobody in the hall. She scurried down to her own room where her suitcases were, pulled the bed covers around, tossed the pillow to the foot of the bed so that it looked like the room's occupant had had a restless night, then headed for the bathroom to begin her morning rituals. A lot of free-floating stress, she thought, as she washed her face. This would be a tough day and potentially a dangerous one. They didn't know anything about what the federal marshals or the drug killers were doing, so they'd be flying blind. On the other hand, Poole was confident in their maze of phony IDs.
They might eventually break them down, but by that time we'll have new ones in a new place.
Box believed him, or believed in him. He hadn't been wrong about much in the time she'd been with him. Not until the Biloxi robbery, anyway. She thought, if only he hadn't done Biloxi. The night before, they'd agreed to stop at the storage unit in Dallas, pull out the truck for Box, and help her load a few pieces of furniture in the back. She'd finished her shower, got dressed, and headed back to Poole's room. As she opened the door, the alarm clock went off. Poole shut it down, and a moment later was up and looking at her.
Been up long?
She shook her head.
Half an hour. I'm all packed. You hit the bathroom, I'll start putting your bag together.
Don't forget to search the room, he said jokingly.
Never.
Wherever they went, whatever they were doing, Box always searched the motel rooms before they left. Once, years before, she had discovered a partially read paperback that Poole would have left behind. On two other occasions, she had found pornographic magazines under mattresses, and while interesting, they belonged to somebody else.
"Call Sturgill. Make sure he's up," Poole said.
He yawned, stretched, and touched his toes.
"Yes."
She called, and Darling was ready to go.
"You need help carrying stuff out to the cars?" he asked.
"If you want to, that'd help," she said.
They'd divided the money in gold the night before, about two-thirds to go with Poole, the other third to be packed in her car, neatly layered in two carbon-fiber suitcases. Darling looked wide awake when he knocked on the door. Between them, they got everything but Poole's duffel bag out to the cars and locked away.
"Still dark," she said, looking up at the bright overhead stars.
"I'm hardly ever awake at this time of day, unless I've stayed up overnight."
"It's early for me, too," Darling agreed. "I usually get up around 5:30. That's the prettiest time."